It's 10:48 a.m. Mohammed Chowdhury, you're in Melbourne,
Correct.
Australia, and it's what, 9:48 p.m.
That's correct. Yes, it's 9:48 on a summer's evening, so it's got dark about an hour and a half ago over here. We've got the
Rub
long
it
days on.
in well
Oh,
you. Oh, yeah, so this is actually our first Zoom recorded oral history interview for the Everyday Muslim Heritage and Archive project. So let's see how it goes. We've had a few
nice.
technical hitches, but there is a big time difference and distance. So let's just go with it and see what happens. So let me start with asking your full name that you were given at birth.
Yes, Muhammad Tufail Chowdhury.
And are there any other names that you're known by now?
I'm generally known by Muhammad, by my friends and colleagues, Tufail in my family, and some people, a lot of people at work call me MC, which has just become a bit of a name, but I'm generally just known as Muhammad, to be honest.
Okay. And can you tell me when you were born?
1966, Sadia, so I was 9th of October, 1966.
And where were you born?
I was born in London, in sort of City of London Hospital, which was somewhere near Shoreditch.
Okay. And can you tell me what do you do? So what's your line of work?
Yeah, I run my own strategy consulting firm called Longstreet Advisors, which focuses on working with mainly government, technology, and telecoms clients around the world in enabling digital technologies and digitization. So that's what I really focus on. And I work with clients in Australia, Asia, and in other parts of the world as well.
And can I ask you a little bit about your parents' occupation? What did they do?
Yeah, sure. So my mum and dad at a time, especially around the time when I was born, they were both working. So my dad, mainly in my adult life, he was a businessman. He had a number of Indian or Bangladeshi restaurants in the UK, and also had a garments factory and some other business interests in Bangladesh. Earlier on in his career, he did other things. I can tell you more about that if you're interested. And then my mum, during most of our lives, was a mother, a stay-at-home mother. But she previously did quite a bit of she did quite a bit of charity work. Worked for a charity in East London. Previously to that, she worked in retail actually before I was born in London.
Okay. I would actually like to know a little bit more about your parents. Anything that you could tell me, especially
Sure.
about your father's businesses, that would be quite interesting to know.
Yeah, sure. And just stop me if I'm going like too far back in history or too slow or anything like that. So my dad, so as I said, I was born in 66. My dad came to the UK in 57, aged 22, with sort of very little by way of resources when he came to the UK. He worked at British Rail in King's Cross Station for about 8 or 9 years. He did some other jobs on the side, and then he sort of saved up sort of enough money to put money down to buy this restaurant in Lewisham, which was in Southeast London. So he opened the restaurant in 1965, just a little bit before I was born.
What was it
And
called?
it was called the Curry Queen. It was a very typical, sort of narrow and long restaurant on a high street, had this sort of wonderful glass front, and it was had the sort of very what you'd now call classic sort of slightly felt type of wallpaper and flowery carpets, and really would fit the stereotype of the of this Indian restaurant, if you like, from the old days. It was super successful. The restaurant was the food was great. We had a very good chef, and it sort of catered to a population in that part of London that loved curry, and our restaurant was one of the local favorites. And so it was a very successful restaurant, and off the back of that, he opened another one, which was in Bedford, just north of London. And then a few years later, we actually opened a chain of four or five other restaurants, and they were in Surrey and Sussex, and they were completely different. So they were like much more catering to well-to-do rural population. Those restaurants were much more much smaller in size, less seating. Much more expensive menus, were also very successful. So then, off the back of all of that, my father generated enough profits to start investing in Bangladesh. So when Bangladesh became independent in the very early 1970s, soon after that, my father started going back to Bangladesh on regular trips. And by about the late 70s, he'd invested in a few new businesses in Bangladesh, including the garments industry, which was Bangladesh is now the world's largest exporter of ready-made garments. It just overtook China. And back then, my dad was one of the pioneers of the garments industry. He was one of the first people to open a garments factory in Bangladesh, which is now a $30 billion industry. So he was actually a real entrepreneur, and made a made his sort of business activities scale up quite a lot from starting with almost nothing, to be honest. My mother was she came to the UK in 1961, also at a quite young age. She was like, I think, about 22 when she came here. And she was a medical student in Dhaka in Bangladesh, or East Pakistan as it was then. She came to the UK for her own medical treatment because she was a little bit unwell, and ended up sort of staying in the UK for a few years, and then my mum and my dad, who were also second cousins, got married in 1964. And then I was born in 66, and my mum did work in retail before I was born. And then soon after I was born, I think she'd stopped working by that stage. And then she started going back to work, working for a charity in East London. That was a lot later. So that was probably when we were in secondary school. So that's probably in the sort of earlier, sort of 1980-ish. She probably went back to work.
Okay. I know from speaking with you before that that your father published a book. Can you tell me a little bit about the book and why he published it?
Yeah, I can do. Yeah, in fact, I could pick it up if you wanted me to. It's about 3 meters away from me. I could go and get it and show it to you on the video. So, he wrote a book called Wait. Let me just go and grab it.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, here we are. So I don't know if you can see that. I'll just put those. I'll just put the blur off. Just give me a sec. The blur? I don't know how to get rid of the blur on. Let me just get out of the picture and see if you can see that. No, you can't. Can you see that? No. It's too blurry. I don't know how to get rid of the blur on Zoom. Oh gosh, there must be a way of doing this, right?
Where it says, does it say stop
Oh,
video?
there we go.
No,
No,
no.
I've got it. I've got it. There we go. Yeah, there's the book. It's called Wage Earners: Working for a Better Bangladesh, and my dad was M.A. Chowdhury. The book was published in the sort of 1990 it was published. And the reason why he wrote the book is because he spent a large part of his time working for a better environment for Bangladeshis who were sort of coming and settling in the UK. So he used to do quite a bit of work in the community, working with local MPs and also with community leaders. He used to be the general secretary of the Bangladesh Caterers Association, which used to look after all of the restaurants. We were quite a few thousand in the UK. What he used to be doing a lot of was campaigning for essentially Bangladeshis who live and work in the UK, but would have a lot of difficulty, weirdly enough, going back to Bangladesh for trips, or to, buy a house or to send money to their family and stuff. There were all sorts of problems with sending money and going. So when we were kids, we'd always used to have to get visas to go to Bangladesh because we all had British passports. The Bangladesh government didn't really pay much attention to UK citizens who were of Bangladeshi origin back then. Now they do, but back then they didn't. And it was quite ironic because a lot of the Liberation War was funded by British expatriate Bangladeshis who raised hundreds of thousands of pounds or millions of pounds, which local Bangladeshis weren't able to do. So if you look at the chapters on this, I mean, you can sort of see that some of the chapter headings will tell you the sorts of stuff he was talking about, which was things like, how to improve the Bangladesh High Commission in London, how to improve Bangladesh Biman's service. Bangladesh Biman was the airline. What to do about currency exchange. What to do about taxation. What to do about visa issue, things like that. So it was a very practical sort of book. My father was not a formally university-educated man. I mean, he left school after the equivalent of his British sort of A-levels was called intermediate in Bangladesh. So the book was written as, the sort of honest advice and perspectives of a migrant who'd gone through a lot of problems and didn't want that to continue. It was a great effort, and quite pioneering. There weren't that many migrants at the time who would go to the effort of writing a book that would then obviously get into the hands of all sorts of policymakers and people like that. So even though he didn't have the formal university education, I think he sort of had the clarity of thinking and the mindset to engage with decision makers. And that's something which I personally benefited a lot from observing my father doing, because basically do that for a living now, running a consultancy firm that advises on national, I advise a lot on national strategies for digitization. Basically, I would say that the attitude of engaging power, people in power, and looking to change things is probably something I initially would have gotten inspiration from my father.
Absolutely, it was definitely very forward thinking. Was he part of the liberation movement that was happening in the time? What was his role, or
Very
how did?
involved, very involved. So you'll actually see that the book that the so firstly, he was the convener of all of the UK fundraising that was done for the liberation effort in 1971. So I still remember going to Trafalgar Square, aged 4. It's one of my earliest memories, on a massive sort of march that ended in Trafalgar Square. He was instrumental in all of the fundraising that happened in the UK. And in fact, when he died in 1991, but he was decorated by the Bangladesh government after his death. He was awarded a national medal in the about 2 to 3 years after his death, posthumously. And then we also had a very strong connection to the Liberation War because of my great uncle, who in fact this book of my father's is dedicated to his memory, General Osmani. The General Osmani was the leader of the Bangladesh Liberation Forces, so he was the commander in chief of the freedom fighters. And then after Bangladesh became independent, he was the first Minister of Defence, the Minister of Civil Aviation in Bangladesh. So he was my great uncle, and so my mother grew up in his house in Sylhet, in Bangladesh, and my father was very close to him. And so not only was my father involved in fundraising for the effort, but we had a direct family connection to the leader of the liberation struggle. And he was someone that I personally took lots of inspiration from. I was extremely close to him myself until his death. So we were deeply involved. I'd say we were a family that was deeply involved in the liberation.
And
And
where did you?
suffered a lot as well. So my father's village in Sylhet in northeast Bangladesh, most of the people who lived in his village were killed in 1971, because of the genocide that was happening. So hundreds of people from his village that he came from were literally murdered in 1971.
I was going to ask you about where did the community convene to have these meetings? Was there a did each area kind of have their own place, or did the community from different parts of the country together? How were the efforts organized?
It's a great question. So I think that I may not be able to do justice to it because I was probably a bit too young to remember it all directly, but even up to the age of, when I was even 20, my dad was still doing a lot of stuff in the community, and I was, sometimes I would go with him to meetings. So what I would say is that there were definitely different ecosystems of communities in different parts of the UK. Like there was definitely an ecosystem in London that was quite distinct from the ecosystem in Birmingham and then in Manchester and so on and so forth. So the one in London, until that sort of 1980s period, was very much centered around Brick Lane in East London. So as you might be aware, Brick Lane in East London has still got a very sort of strong concentration of Bangladeshi origin population. But even back then, Brick Lane was a little bit of a magnet for community meetings about Bangladesh. So I still remember going to Brick Lane with my dad, in the 1980s when I was like in my teenage years, doing things like, I remember once we went to a meeting which was held at Brick Lane Mosque, which was to raise funds to convert the gravel road that went from the trunk road to my dad's village. So it was like 4 kilometers, which was all gravel and mud. And I remember there was a fundraising meeting to tarmac the road, and they needed something like £20,000 equivalent or something like that to do the tarmac. And I remember they raised about 40,000 in about 2 hours, and they had all this money, and then they got the tarmac done, they got the brick done, and I've driven along that tarmac road more recently, still there. So there were all those sorts of activities that would happen, and it was tremendous how these seemingly lower middle class Bangladeshi migrants, you wouldn't really think they were that well off. They'd rock up at a meeting and they'd all shell out, £1,000, £2,000 each, as a commitment, as a pledge, and then the money would get raised. So,
Back in the 80s, that was a lot of money. So.
that was a lot of money. I still remember the figure was something like 20,000, which I guess in today's money might be sort of, I don't know, 3 or 4 times that amount. It was a lot of money back then. I think if you got the right issue and it meant something to people, I think they would get the money out, to be honest with you. It would happen. I think a lot of the center of gravity was around Brick Lane back then. We used to live in Southeast London, where near Lewisham, where the restaurant was. Whilst there were quite a few Bangladeshis living in all of these areas, There wasn't like that much of a critical mass to bring people together to have big meetings of that sort. I mean, obviously, you would have meetings in people's houses and stuff, but not quite at that scale.
And do you remember any sort of names of the people that were part of the of these meetings, people who would have been part of
Yeah,
the
absolutely. I can actually remember one or two names, and I could find out other names. I mean, the most memorable person was a gentleman called Tasudduk Ahmed. Tasudduk Ahmed was like a very significant person in the Bangladeshi community during my childhood. So he's passed away now. I think he was probably 10 years older than my father, so he would have been born in the 1920s. He was a convener of all sorts of Bangladeshi gatherings, a fierce nationalist, a really nice man, a very gentle sort of person, and a real leader in the community. So he was, for example, very strongly aligned with people like Peter Shaw, MP. So Peter Shaw was the Labour MP of Bethnal Green during the sort of 70s and 80s. So in the sort of Harold Wilson, Michael Foot, Labour governments, Peter Shaw was a prominent MP. So Tasudduk Ahmed would do a lot of work with him. Tasudduk Ahmed was a very well-studied person. I can't remember what his profession was, but he was a very well-studied, educated person and was a great leader. Another person I can remember was a counselor in his later years. So Mushtaq Qureshi. So Mushtaq Qureshi was based in more towards the west. So he would be Lisson Grove, that sort of area. He was a counselor from there. He was the first Bangladeshi to enter formal politics in the UK, from all I can remember. So I think he was the first person of Bangladeshi origin to be voted in as a councillor in the UK. And at that time, there were no Bangladeshi origin MPs or people in the House of Lords. So he was pretty much the first Bangladeshi origin person to be in formal politics, I would say. He was a distant uncle of mine, and another amazing leader, significantly involved in fundraising for the Liberation War, deeply sort of loyal to his community, and a great leader. He died not that long ago, probably maybe 7 or 8 years ago. It was when he passed. So I can remember those two. There were clearly many, many others. I just don't remember all of the names, but those two were, very significant people. Mushtaq Qureshi's son, whose name is Murad Qureshi, was also a councillor and was then a member of the London Assembly as well, an MLA. I don't know if he's still a member of the London Assembly, but he was for a number of years. Right up to the point when Boris Johnson was Mayor of London, he was a member of the London Assembly. He's my cousin. I'm not sure what he's doing right now, but yeah, so the sort of tradition continued in the family. In fact, my father was extremely keen for me to enter UK politics. Which if you were to say, do I have any regrets in life? I've got a few. That would be one of them, right? Which is that I didn't sort of take the opportunity to get into politics because I think I could have been a nice way to try to make a bit more of a difference. But he was pretty keen for me to get involved, which is why he used to take me to those Tasudduk Ahmed and Peter Shaw meetings and whatnot. And because I was lucky enough to study at Oxford, and I was one of the first British-born Bangladeshis to go to Oxford, and I did politics and philosophy and economics, I had the right sort of credentials and background to make my way in politics. He was really keen. But then my father died a year after I finished my master's degree. So I did my master's at Cambridge. I did an MPhil in economics at Cambridge straight after Oxford. And then a year later, my father was dead. And you know, he was very encouraging of me to get into politics. And I just never really followed it up, but think he was the sort of
He's a
person
really
that wanted change in the society, wanted change in the community. Sorry, you were gonna say.
gonna say, was there a reason why you didn't go down that path?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I think back at the time, I was sort of quite interested in working internationally, and I was quite interested in working in developing countries. So, after I finished my master's in economics at Cambridge, I joined a consultancy firm in the UK, the firm that's now called PwC. So I joined that firm as a graduate, and I've got the opportunity to start working in the Middle East and in the former Soviet republics and a little bit in Eastern Europe. And I really, really enjoyed that work. And I've continued working in those sorts of geographies throughout a lot of my career. So I think I was really driven by that, and I felt like I really wanted to build a career like that. My father never really wanted me to go into the family restaurant business. In fact, he sold the business just before he died. He had sold it. And politics, I just never really took it seriously, to be honest with you. I don't think I ever really looked at it as a career. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't think I ever saw it as a career. When I look at it now, I feel like, one could probably achieve quite a lot in politics. But back then, I never really saw it as a career. I was offered a councillorship option a few years after my father's death. They contacted me and offered me a seat. But I just declined. I just said I'm not that keen. As it happened in the last 15 years, I've done loads of work with politicians because I've done lots of work advising at the cabinet level in various countries around the world. And I can see how effective politicians can make a difference. I can also see how difficult it is to be an effective politician, but I can see how that can make a difference. So there is a side of me that sort of goes, maybe that could have been an option one day. And my kids, even though I'm like, I've been a senior partner in a big consulting firm, and I run my own business now, and I've worked in all sorts of weird and wonderful places. My kids always like bringing me down to earth and sort of going, "Dad, you're a failure because you never became prime minister of your country." I go, "Thanks very much. It's great." Yeah.
Oh gosh. I was going to ask, well, it sounds like you've been making some changes in a different way from the work that you're doing. I just wanted to go back a little bit to the liberation of Bangladesh in 71, 72. Do you remember that time? Do you remember what the atmosphere was with community, what you did, was there a celebration? Oh, just tell me a little bit about that time.
Absolutely. So I do remember that time, and it's I was four when the Liberation War began. I remember it well because there was a great deal of fear and worry about it, because we all had family members that were seriously affected by the war, and all we do is just hear stories back in London about what was going on, and with communications not being so immediate back then, the stories would come dripping through on telegrams or through people that were able to get out from time to time, and they would always be incomplete, and we would be in huge worry about all of our relatives that were there because we would never know who was safe. I remember one of my cousins, his father, so my uncle basically was killed by the army in Khulna, by the Pakistan army in Khulna. So he was like an electrical engineer, and he was at the site of a power line that had gone down during fighting, and he was at the power line trying to direct the technicians to fix the power line. And the army found him and shot him. So he was dead. So those cousins of mine, I've grown up with those cousins. So there were all sorts of things like that that we used to keep hearing the stories about, which was pretty shocking, to be honest. Stories of other cousins of mine who were so scared of the army raiding all the villages that my cousins still tell me the story now. It's about the same age as me, that they used to hide under the bed in the bedroom in the village in Sylhet, and they would literally see the Pakistan army, the soldiers' boots, like walking past through the house, and they wouldn't see them hiding under the bed, and then they walk out. And they were obviously, I mean, he was like, what? He's a bit older. He was like 6 years old back then. A lot of stories like that. Some stories of great bravery as well. Like my father's brother once spent a few hours hiding with my great uncle, General Osmani, hiding in a sort of cesspool of water where the army was going by. And they were just sort of under the water and just sort of breathing somehow for a few hours. And then they came back out the water again, stuff like that. But, you know, I'd say that I could show you something very historic. Again, if you gave me 15 seconds, I could go and grab something, which can you allow 15 seconds? You can edit this a little bit, right? Just give me a few seconds.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to show you something which is probably a museum piece. So this is a T-shirt. I'm just going to open it up. I'll just open up this T-shirt. The T-shirt says "Help Bangladesh," right? So this T-shirt is from Trafalgar Square, 1971. So I've just kept it. I've always preserved it. I never wear it because I don't want to like damage it. So I haven't worn this even once in the last 15 or 20 years, I don't think. It's faded at the back. So the back's all faded. I don't even get the color. The back's all yellowy. The front's still a bit white. So that T-shirt, I still remember there was a whole sale of these T-shirts in Trafalgar Square. And obviously, all the money was going towards fundraising. So, that's like, I don't know, that's 53 years old, that T-shirt. You know, that's another memory of mine from that time. And I guess after Bangladesh became independent, the first time we went was 1974. So it's probably about 3 years after independence was when the first time we made a trip there as a family. And I still remember that trip. So we went on Hajj. So I was about six and a half, nearly 7 years. I was about seven. So we went from London to Makkah and we did Hajj. I remember Hajj it was early in the year. It was like about January or that sort of time of the year. We did Hajj, and then from Hajj we went to Bangladesh, and I still remember that trip to Bangladesh. So Bangladesh then was 3 years after independence, very fresh, very new. My great uncle was a minister, so he was a, you know, we used to go and visit him, and that was we'd see all the things that he was doing, but the country was in a pathetic state. I mean, you know, the a lot of the assets have been destroyed. I think the airline had, I think, two aircraft at the time, because the army, when they were leaving after defeat, bombed all the aircraft that were left on the landing strip. So there was nothing left behind. I mean, it was terrible. There was massive poverty. You know, I still remember that I think the average age life expectancy for a rickshaw driver was like 28 or something. You know, it was just like terrible. There was massive malnutrition. Food was being imported, but there was a lack of foreign currency. It was all that sort of stuff. I still remember a lot of that. Also, because people like my dad were very involved, and they talk about this sort of stuff a lot. So I guess I just picked it up through the conversations. And you know what? I mean, I'm sort of drifting a bit now in the conversation, so just stop me if you want to. But I think those early years of dealing with the pathetic situation of my home country instilled in me a sense of A, despair, B, probably a bit of anger, if you like. I don't think the anger was against what had happened in 1971, not for me, because I wasn't personally affected by it, although I'd heard so many stories. But the anger was more like the injustice of poverty, if you like, right? And because it was in your face in such a big way. And then we come back to England. And of course, England was prosperous and stable and, all that sort of thing. I mean, the contrast in life between that sort of stable, quite well-to-do life in London. And, by the early 70s, we had our own detached house. We had two cars. I used to go to private school. And then the sort of abject poverty and despair in Bangladesh. I mean, the contrast between these two was so startling. I think that really affected me, to be honest. And that's probably why I work in digital technologies today, is because I believe in change that can enable, a lot more people to get access to a lot more goods and services than before. So that had a massive impact on my outlook in life, to be honest. It was shaped by that environment, by that time, but also I'd say influenced and shaped by my own parents, the way they worked through these crises. My mum and my dad, I can tell you, I never heard them say negative things about what was happening in the war, or anger, or it was more about stoic, determination to try and like, okay, how can we solve this? How can we solve this? That was really what consumed them. I think I learned a lot from that as well, actually.
So, as a child, how did you navigate this, all of this happening in the background, in school and sort of outside of the home? How did that work?
Yeah, very challenging. Good question, and very challenging, I would say, because we were experiencing all of this, and we were aware of all of this happening. Yet when you go to school, of course, it's a different world. I mean, the world at school is completely oblivious of what's happening in Bangladesh, which is a country halfway around the other side of the world. Not necessarily in people's mind's eye as to what's happening. And it's not necessarily the case that my teachers or my friends at school had much idea of what was happening. So it was a very, it was a contrast, I would say. We did have almost split lives. When you come home, I mean, life for me with Bengali. We would eat Bengali food, we would speak Bangla at home, but when I'm at school, it's completely different. I'm speaking English, I'm interacting with friends, none of whom are Bengali. They're all mainly English or from other country origins, mainly English. So completely different lives, if you like. I was comfortable in each life, but I guess there was a bit of a translation needed, as you come home from school, and as you get into school in the morning, a bit of a translation needed. It wasn't like a continuous culturally same journey, right? So there was that. In terms of the Bangladesh war, I mean, soon after the war was over, it's not as though I wouldn't be wanting to say that what was happening in Bangladesh was affecting my mindset on a daily basis. That wouldn't be right to say that. It definitely affected me, and I was aware of it. And when I would see it, it would affect me and impact me a lot. But it's not as though I'd go to school every day thinking about the Bangladesh war or situation back home either. So it was more like, I think, just dealing with, you know, the stark difference between effectively having two types of identities, you know. I think that was probably more what it was about. Yeah, I still remember the day back in 71, probably about November, I reckon, when my uncle, that was my dad's, another one of my dad's younger brothers, who's now lives in Bromley, Kent, and he's now 82 years old. I remember the day he walked into our house in 1971. He'd escaped from East Pakistan and gotten himself out, and then managed to somehow, over the course of about a week's journeying, got himself to London as a refugee. And then my dad went and picked him up from the airport and brought him home. I still remember that day when he walked in. Quite emotional, actually. But yeah, I mean, you know, that was the life back then. It was really just about keeping both sides of the life up at the same time.
Tell me about your childhood outside of that. What did you most enjoy about being a child?
Yeah, wonderful childhood. Gosh, I mean, riding my bike. I mean, you know, I going on massively long bike rides. You know, going further and further each time. You know, by the time I was 13, I was probably cycling 3 to 4 miles away from home and starting back. And by the time I was 16, it was probably like 10 miles. And, you know, so cycling around was great. Cycling around with my friends, wide variety of friends from all sorts of nationalities, no real boundaries, cultural boundaries. Playing a lot with my cousins. So the cousins that I mentioned who lost their father, who was repairing the electricity pole, they ultimately migrated to the UK. We're all about the same age. And so playing with them, that was a massive thing. We used to play together a lot. A lot of cricket, massive cricket fan, still am. A lot of cricket. What else? Took school quite seriously, to be honest. I mean, did work quite hard at school. I always struggled at school in my first few years. I only started doing slightly better when I was probably 2 to 3 years away from O-levels. Before that, I was just sort of plodding along. But, you know, worked hard at school. Say again?
What are the names of the schools that you went to?
Oh, yeah. My first sort of junior school, primary school, was a place called Riverston, which is on Sidcup Road in Eltham, London SC9. And then, or London SC12, my mistake. And then secondary school, I went to St Dunstan's College, which is in Catford, London SC6. So that took me all the way through to finishing my A-levels before I went to university. And yeah, school was also, you know, sports at school. So I used to do cricket, judo, rugby in the winter, which I didn't really enjoy. I was crap at sports. I was okay at cricket, not bad at cricket, but I was pretty much crap at everything else. I did 2 years of military training, sort of combined cadet force, which I ended up being quite good at, weirdly enough. And then school trips overseas occasionally. So every year we'd have at least one French trip, and possibly a slightly longer trip somewhere. We'd have school camps every now and then in England, some of which were good fun, some of which were pretty awful. But lots of school activities. Really good friends. So I had 3 or 4 really close friends, and actually 2 of them are still really close friends of mine today. So sort of 45 years later, we're still really close friends. In fact, I'm seeing one of them for dinner 1 week from today in Paris, we're going to meet up for dinner because I'm flying to Europe in a couple of days' time, and I'm going to meet him in Paris for dinner. So, some really, really strong friendships, and cross-cultural friendships. We were a little bit unlike some of our family, extended family in England, which whereby we me I had friends from all faiths and backgrounds. Some of my relatives, also in my community, didn't necessarily mix that much outside the community, but I had friends from all different backgrounds, and still do.
Can you tell me a little bit about what influenced your choice of subjects and your chosen career path?
Yeah, sure. So the other thing I was really interested in as a kid was cars. I'm a complete car fanatic. I'm total gearhead, as they say. Still am. And so I was actually, my career goal was to be a car designer. That was the thing that I was really keen on doing. So I was going to apply to do aeronautical engineering, which was the course that was like back then suitable for going into car design later on. So I was going to apply for aeronautical engineering at Southampton University. I still remember going there for an open day. But then when I saw what engineers do at university, which is basically do lots of lab work and all that, I somehow it didn't link with my whole vision of being some sort of dude car designer, probably living in Milan, right? And of course, I'd completely omitted the fact that you don't just become a car designer who lives in Milan. You have to go through all these hard yards of qualifying and learning. And of course, I just wasn't up for it. I just wasn't interested in that. So I made a snap decision, which was that I'm not going to be a car designer anymore. I'm actually going to do economics. So I decided to do economics instead. That's what really influenced my sort of direction of going towards economics. And then when it came to applying to university, I was absolutely determined I wanted to go to Oxford or Cambridge. And I've got fixated by it, to be honest. Some of my best mates had got into Oxford, and I think that was a big draw for me to really do the same. And so Oxford didn't offer economics. It only offered what's called politics, philosophy, and economics. Cambridge offered economics straight, but I was more interested in going to Oxford. So that's why I applied to do politics, philosophy, and economics. That was what drew me towards that decision for a degree.
Did you have any regrets about that, or did you enjoy your course?
No regrets at all. So I went in not having really studied politics or philosophy before. I'd done economics for A levels, but absolutely loved politics and philosophy, to be honest. I just loved the liberation of being able to think about anything you like and to be able to argue, use logic, have moral arguments. I really loved it. And probably because I'd had that childhood of being exposed to politics, through my dad and then through my great uncle. I think that probably had its influence on me by that stage as well. So I really gotten into it, got into it, I mean. I didn't know how to write essays because I'd never really been taught at school how to do any of that stuff. So I struggled in my first year at Oxford. I failed my philosophy, what's called prelims, which is your first year exams. I had to retake them. So I was actually really scared that I was going to fail again and then get thrown out. But anyway, I managed to get through fine. Second and third years, I just had a ball. I really, really enjoyed what I was studying. Didn't study that hard, to be honest. I studied, quite hard for my final exams, but in my second year, I didn't really study much at all. I spent a lot more time doing extracurricular activities, mainly Oxford Majlis. So Oxford Majlis was the South Asian Society for undergraduates, very famous, founded in 1905 by Indian students who wanted decolonization of British India, led by various prominent later politicians. So Indira Gandhi, who was the Prime Minister of India in the 1970s, was a president of the Majlis in the 1960s, I think, early 60s when she was there. Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was a president of the Majlis, who was the father of Benazir Bhutto and was Prime Minister of Pakistan. Liaquat Ali Khan was, and a few other people, a few other really famous political leaders. And I got really involved in Majlis, and I became the president of the Majlis myself in 1988. And then I was responsible for running this organization, which was had 300 or 400 members, and we used to run two speaker events every week. And so we would have people like ambassadors, we would have politicians, academics, and so on. I met some really interesting people during that period of time. Some people who are still prominent and active in politics even now. You know, I put all my focus into the Majlis, and I didn't really study that hard at all, to be honest. But I enjoyed my studies.
Why was the Majlis so important?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think I think it was all about finding myself, to be honest. So I reckon that by the time I went to Oxford, I probably thought I knew who I was, but I realized when I got there that I didn't really know who I was, because, you know, I was a fairly, you know, sort of responsibly practicing Muslim, you know, but when I went to Oxford, because I was surrounded by libertarian sort of way of life, and, you know, students who are, you know, who have all been let free from their homes and they were doing whatever they wanted, you know, I really struggled, because I was like trying to stick to this regime of being a Muslim, right? Yet I was surrounded by people who weren't interested in any particular structure of life or faith. And I found myself sort of interacting with them in a way that I was trying to almost make a point about the fact that I was a Muslim, right? Doing it in a way that I probably wouldn't do at all today. But back then, I wasn't comfortable in who I was doing what I was doing, but I wasn't necessarily, hadn't yet matured enough to be comfortable in it. So I had to make a point of it all the time. And then I found out that I knew, even though I've just been talking about the Bangladesh Liberation War and this and that, I found that I really didn't know much about where I came from. You know, I didn't know much about the history of the Indian subcontinent. I didn't know anything about British colonialism, for example. I didn't know much about how India was partitioned. I didn't know much about how Pakistan was set up or how Bangladesh got created from a political perspective. I didn't really understand much about it until I went to Oxford and studied it. So I think I was really learning a lot about stuff that was really relevant to my own identity. And Majlis, I think, magnetized me into that, because I realized, because when I first used to see the Majlis meetings, I would be embarrassed, because I would sort of think, right, they're going to talk about the Kashmir issue, or they're going to talk about the Naxalites, which was some left-wing sort of movement in India, or they're going to talk about, you know, the Tamils and the Sinhalese in Sri Lanka. And I would just sort of think, I don't know what's going on in these places. I've got no idea, right? And I felt embarrassed. But over the course of time, over a year or so, I really started becoming a bit more familiar with all this. And I think I was a bit in awe of some of the students who were the slightly more older students at the Majlis when I first joined it. But by the time I'd been doing it for a year or so, I became more confident in myself. And so I think I really got magnetized into the Majlis because of that. If you allow me another minute, I could probably pull out a couple of Majlis term cards and show you them, if that's useful for your video. Yeah. Just give me a minute. See if I can find one. I think I have got a couple somewhere. I do have them, but I can't, I just can't find them. Let me have one quick look. It's a terrible shame. I wish I'd thought about it beforehand. I can't find them. If I do locate them and they're around here somewhere, I'll send you a few screenshots if you want. But they're really interesting. They're 35-year-old term cards with, which will tell you about all these great speakers who are coming all from the Indian subcontinent. Some really famous people actually. So, yeah, I'll try and track it down. So it was
Do you have
really
any?
a really quite privilege. Yeah, gone.
I was asking if there were any publications that were related to the Majlis. Did they have their own publications or anything similar to that?
They've still got a website, and the history of the Majlis is available there. Somebody's written a history of the Majlis, I think. The Majlis can claim credit for a lot of the lobbying that was done about British decolonization of India. In the 1930s and 40s, the Majlis also goes through ebbs and flows. So it's always had a decade when it's been really active, and then it's had a decade when it's been quiet, and then vice versa again. It goes through ebbs and flows. It's a very storied institution. It's very well known amongst those people who have been in that sort of community. Yeah. I don't know about any other publications as such. Yeah, but the Oxford Majlis was really something of an institution, like a major institution.
Majlis may have Majlis may have answered part of this question, but in what ways do you feel that Oxford supported or accommodated your cultural and religious practices, if at all?
I think the university as a whole was ambivalent to your faith. I think the university was inclusive and open-minded. I don't think there was any restrictions or influencing towards the practice of your faith, to be honest. But my time at Oxford was characterized by, some challenges around faith, to be honest. Partly, I'd say personal challenges, which is that I struggled with, I never struggled with my belief, but I struggled with practice and regularity of practice, when it comes to things like praying, like 5 times a day. During my Oxford years, I'd say that my praying was diminished to, twice a day or something. Like it really, really diminished in my own mind. But then, so there was personal struggles, if you like, with discipline and so on. There was a lot of challenging of faith, by other students who were saying, "Why do you believe in this? Why do you do that? Why do you fast 30 days a year and things like that?" Which, of course, one would expect when you go to a university because you're surrounded by clever and curious people, and they ask all sorts of questions, right? So that was actually probably a good thing, not a bad thing. But at the time, I saw it as an attack because I wasn't mature enough to deal with it. So I saw it as an attack, and I got really defensive about it, which was probably not the right reaction, but it was the best I could manage at the time. So there was that. which I would say, funnily enough, probably strengthened my faith in the long term rather than weakened it, because it sort of made me think about it harder, which was a good thing. There was the odd racist incident, I would say. I can remember two. One was we held a Majlis dinner, end of term dinner at a college in Oxford. I won't name the college. And, we sort of served biryani and kebabs and things like that. It was a very successful dinner. And then the next day, we got a letter from the warden of the college saying that, the staff had complained of curry smells in the hall, right? Which I thought was racist. And I wrote back to him expressing that feeling. And then they sort of withdrew their complaint. And then I was once called a mad mullah by somebody in my college, who shouted it out from a window as I was walking through like a quad, like a garden area in the college. And I was furious about that. That was round about the time when the Satanic Verses was published by Salman Rushdie, if you remember
I
that.
was about to ask, was it related to any particular
Yeah, it was
incident or,
related to that. So it was related to that because when the Salman Rushdie book was published, he came to Oxford to do a reading at Blackwell's on High Street, on Broad Street. And I attended the reading, and actually had a bit of a conversation with him. But then I wrote a letter to the Times, which was published, which sort of said something along the lines of the book, we should respect, the freedom of speech of the writer. However, the book has damaged the self-respect of many people in the Muslim community, and that shouldn't be allowed, right? So that got published in the Times, and I got a lot of racist sort of hate mail for that because they published my college address, and I received probably about 20 letters in the post, for 15 of which were pretty racist, and five of which were like, thank you for writing your letter. So that was quite upsetting. And then I got called the Mad Mullah in the college garden. Anyway, so I then went and tried to find out who it was because I was pretty angry about it. Couldn't really figure it out. I knew which room it had come from, but there were four or five students in the room and nobody would admit who did it. And then I went and complained to the principal. And the principal was a constitutional lawyer, and she'd written the Zimbabwe constitution, and she was like this sort of big authority in constitutional law. And so she took it really seriously. She took it as an infringement of someone's human rights, and she undertook an investigation in the college, and they found out who did it, and they got them to come and apologize. That was the last I heard of it. And I never really tolerated racism, to be honest with you. I didn't tolerate it, to be honest. So that was the only difficult experiences. The rest of it was great. I mean, it was very easy to practice Islam. Oxford had plenty of places for people to access halal meat. There was a fairly decent community within the town outside the university. There was a mosque that was quite active. Now it's this beautiful mosque now in Oxford, but even back then it was a reasonably decent mosque. So all that was good. Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies was there, which I did go to every now and then. There was an Oxford University Muslim Society, which was pretty useful as well, which I'd go to sometimes too. So yeah, it was actually very good.
Did your college have a designated prayer space, or was there somewhere that you could go to pray?
No, there wasn't at all. I mean, there was a college chapel. Every college had a chapel, which is completely understandable because the origins of Oxford University are associated with, Christian culture and values. But there were no separate prayer spaces, and to be honest with you, I never expected one because we all lived on college. I mean, the colleges. This policy was for everyone to live on college, and I had a room in college. So I was never more than 5 minutes walk away from my room. So there was never any need to have a prayer room to pray in. I would expect that today it's a different day and age, and I expect that there probably would be prayer rooms in college now, but back then there wasn't. But it was never regarded as, I never regarded that as an issue or an impediment to offering my prayers.
And what was the name of the local mosque? Do you remember where it was?
We just used to call it the Cowley Road Mosque. I mean, it was on Cowley Road. It probably did have a name, but I don't remember the name. We just used to call it Cowley Road. I think they've got a modern mosque there now, which has won some architectural awards for its design. I've been there once. Many years ago, I was there about 15 years ago. I can't really remember it, to be honest, but I believe it's a very beautiful mosque now. When we were there, it was just a collection of old buildings that had been knocked together into a single mosque. But it did the job. It was perfectly good.
Did you do you remember much about the community at the mosque, where they were from?
There's very much a sort of, I mean, double community in the mosque, because the mosque was broadly serving the Muslim community that was resident in Oxford as opposed to university students. So there was a lot of community in Oxford, as you can imagine, because Oxford was an industrial town. There was a car factory, the Morris or Mini factory was in Oxford. So as you can imagine, there were thousands and thousands of Pakistanis and Bangladeshis in particular, who were migrants who used to work at those factories. So Oxford, being an industrial centre, had a large number of migrants. So mosque mainly served their needs. But then the university did have quite a few Muslims who would turn up at the mosque as well. So there'd be a smattering of Pakistanis, you know, literally two or three Bangladeshis, you know, a couple of Mauritians, a couple of Africans, and probably a few Malaysians, you know, who would turn up at the mosque. We would be the odd ones out. I mean, you know, the vast majority of people praying would be sort of local Oxford residents. But the mosques were fine. They were very similar to the atmosphere in mosques in London, like in Euston or in East London, etc. Not different. Probably not a lot of women going to the mosque back then, I would say, compared to what you might find today. But nothing else to note, really. I knew a lot of people in the community because of Majlis. So we used to have to do quite a lot of fundraising for Majlis. And one way we would raise funds would be to get advertisements in the term card every term. And the advertisements would be, we would get a lot of advertisements from local Indian restaurants. Me being of a Bangladeshi background, I would always find it quite easy to get their money, because I would go in, I would speak to them in Bengali, and they would go, oh, you're in Oxford. Oh, wow. They'd be really proud of me. And then they'd be happily giving some money for the advertisement. And so I think we used to charge £50 for every advertisement. And, you know, if we get like, say, £400 from advertisements, that was like really good income for our society. So I'd be up and down Cowley Road a few times every couple of months, you know, trying to get advertisements for the term card. And usually I'd be quite successful. So I knew the community quite well. And they knew, some of them knew me, because I was one of the only Bangladeshi kids who was actually at the university. So that way I've got to know some of them quite well.
Do you remember the names of any of the restaurants?
Yeah, I really wish I could find those term cards for you, actually, because I'd be able to show you the ads. There was Moonlight Restaurant. That was really a great one. Moonlight Restaurant, which was on Cowley Road. I was probably still there, actually. I think it was the Taj of India, I think it was called, which was right in the middle of Oxford, right in the middle of the university. on Turl Street, I think it was. I can't remember some of the other names, to be honest, but Moonlight was a stalwart for us. And I still remember the one night when we had a majlis, a cultural event, and it was a sitar and tabla recital by famous Pakistani tabla player called Ustad Allah Raka and his son Zakir Khan, who are Ustad Allah Raka is dead, but Zakir Khan is famous, a famous tabla player today. So they came to Oxford to do a recital and it was a huge success. I remember driving down to London in my little car to pick them up and bring them for the concert. After the concert, we all decided to go to the Moonlight restaurant for dinner and so I rocked up at the Moonlight restaurant with these superstars of classical music, and the waiters were like completely gobsmacked. And we had this amazing dinner. I was probably about 15 or 20 of us, had this amazing dinner. I still remember nights like that. There would have been a night when the Pakistan cricket team was in town, led by Imran Khan, and there would have been a dinner at the Moonlight again with the Pakistan cricket team. Those were just phenomenal evenings. You were just amazing evenings. And of course, the restaurants would love it because we would always rock up with famous people. It was good business for them, but it was also really memorable. Take pictures, hang them up on the wall, and stuff like that. So some really good memories from that sort of interaction from the with the local Oxford resident community.
I was going to ask about photographs. Would you have any, or do you know if anybody has any of the nights?
I'd have to do some research. I don't think I've got, I probably have actually. I will just need to dig them out. I think I know where they are, which is in the shed somewhere in a cardboard box. So I can't promise you, but I'll give it a look and try and dig some out if I can. For some reason, I haven't really organized those photos properly. So I'll see if I could find some. I just wish I could find you a couple of those majlis term cards. And if you're able to give me another minute, I might just want to give it another look just to see if I can drag them out. Because if I could show them to you on the video, I think it would be. Do you mind if I just have another quick look? See if I can find them. Yeah, just give me a sec. I have a feeling they might be in here. No. No, it's just not my luck, I'm afraid. What I could do, if you're interested, is if I find them, which I will be able to, I just need a bit of time. If you wanted to do another short video call, we could maybe just do another short one with a few. With me showing you a few of those term
Yeah,
cards,
that
and
would
if
be
you
my.
sort of,
That would be really helpful.
yeah, I reckon that might be really worth it. I've got a lot of other historical stuff that I'm just able to dig out. Like, if you look at that, for example, that's from the
Oh,
nine.
amazing.
That, you remember I told you that we went to Bangladesh in 1974 after Hajj? That was
Oh,
that trip, right? So that's that's my dad straight after Hajj. That's my mum. Think I must be sitting here somewhere. Can't see myself. I think that I can't see where I am here, but I've got no, that's me down there. So we've sort of got I've got lots of photos like this. You can even see the stamp on the back there. It's written in Bangla of the photo. I've got a lot of stuff actually. But I probably just wasn't thinking about it in that way for the call. But now that I'm aware of what you're looking for, I reckon I could probably get a few more. There's a picture of my dad from the 1960s. I've got lots of this sort of stuff. I could, if you're interested, you think it's worthwhile for your project, I
it would
could.
be it'll be hugely photographs and anything in terms of documentation is hugely important for the archive because those are the historical records of that time. So I would implore you to go and dig those
I mean,
things out
I've
from
got
Asia.
access to a lot of stuff, right? So I mean, look at this. I mean, that's a family tree of my father's side of the family, going all the way back to going back about six generations. So that's going back to probably about 1800.
That's amazing.
So I've got a few things that I could I've now appreciated sort of given the direction that your questions are taking, what you're looking for. So if you're not if you don't mind, I mean, maybe we could do a I know we've been trying to do this interview over the last 2 years or something, but I could find the term cards and we could perhaps do it based sitting in the same place, so you could easily, like, wear the same shirt again if you want, whatever. And then you could edit it in.
No, that's absolutely fine, however you do it. Sort of staying back on you as being a Muslim, how did you feel your identity as a Muslim played a role in shaping your personal and academic journey, if at all, while you were in Oxford?
Yeah, it's making me think. I don't necessarily think my identity as a Muslim shaped my academic journey, to be honest. I think I was very clear about my identity as a Muslim. I was very clear that I was a Muslim. I wasn't necessarily practicing as thoroughly as a Muslim as I had done before going to university, or I did resume after. But I never had any faltering in my faith, and I never really got involved in any activities which went directly against my faith, in terms of partying or drinking, etc., or taking drugs or any of that stuff. However, I wouldn't say that my religious identity or faith shaped my academic career, if you see what I mean. I mean, I think that I certainly took a lot of interest in political history, of the Middle East and of the Indian subcontinent, and I studied some of that. And it was a revelation to me to find out more about the impacts of colonialism and decolonization. But those were more like academic interests, if you like. And
Do you
I, you know,
think,
I said, yeah, go on.
so do you think that academic knowledge had any impact on your thoughts and feelings about the independence struggle? Did it change anything, or do you think was it just that it became more informed of that period?
No, it certainly informed me a lot more because I learned a lot more about the independence struggle from a facts and figures and sort of political developments perspective, which I had never really understood. And my tutor, my politics tutor for politics of South Asia, was a man called Dr. Gauhar Rizvi. Now, Dr. Rizvi was himself a freedom fighter. He then went on to be a professor at Harvard after being at Oxford, and he's now the Bangladesh Prime Minister's chief foreign affairs advisor. So he was my tutor for politics of South Asia. So learning from people like him, we got a detail around the liberation struggle and the reasons for it all the way from 1947 up to 71 that. I'd never been aware of prior to going to university in that detail. That was amazing, to get that. So that gave me a really, really good grounding in understanding that. It didn't necessarily impact me emotionally, but it just helped me frame it and understand it better. Which was truly invaluable. And I went to see Dr. Rizvi like probably about 5 years ago. I was in Dhaka. I got in touch with him, and I went to the Prime Minister's office, which is where his office is, and I met him. And that's the first time I'd seen him in like 30 years. And he embraced me, gave me a big hug, said it was so good for him to see one of his old students. I wasn't necessarily one of his most distinguished students, but he was very, very happy to see me.
Were any of your family, or do you know if any of your family were impacted directly by the partition in 1947?
Oh yeah, massively. Yeah, there's hardly anybody who wasn't. I mean, there was a huge impact, especially on my mother's side of the family. I've spoken quite a bit about my father and stuff. On my mother's side, my grandfather, so my mother's father, was from West Bengal. So he wasn't from what is now Bangladesh. He was from what is now India. He was from Calcutta or near Calcutta. He was a principal of a college in Calcutta at the time of partition in 1947. So the partition directly impacted him because he was either going to become an Indian or he would have to make a decision and move to East Pakistan if he wanted to be a Pakistani. Now, he was a very observant Muslim. He came from a very strictly observant Muslim family. So for him, that would have been a big issue to decide what to do. And he had eight children. So my mother was one of eight. Now, what happened was that a week after partition, so in August 1947, he died. And so he left my grandmother, a widow, 1 week after partition. And when he died, and as you know from the history, there was complete chaos in the cross-border situation. And we all famously know about what happened in the cross-border on in Punjab, between Lahore and Jalandhar and Amritsar, etc. But there was obviously the same sort of stuff going on the East as well. So when he died, my grandmother was left widowed with eight children. Now she was from East Bengal. She was from Sylhet herself, right? So she had no roots in West Bengal. So she had to leave. So with her husband dead, she left and went back to that what was then East Pakistan. She crossed the border with her younger children. She left her two older children in Calcutta in college, but the younger one she took with her and she moved. And she had to leave everything behind. So she left her house in Calcutta, didn't get any pensions or anything like that, and she just left with nothing. So that was the reason why my mother grew up in basically in poverty, because there was no source of income anymore. And that is actually why she was so close to General Osmani that I mentioned before in the interview, because General Osmani back then was a young major in the army, right? He was, in fact, the youngest major in the British Army in India, General Osmani. So he was commissioned in 1942, 1942 into the army, into the British Army, that is, right? And he was a major by 1945 or something, and he was very young, and he was the youngest major in the army. So he was then like in the Pakistan Army, but his father was a prominent judge, and his father took my grandmother in. My grandmother was his niece. And said, you come and live here with your children. And that's why my mother was so close to General Osmani, because she grew up in his house, basically. So yeah, that's just one example. I mean, there were many impacts of partition on my family. More so those were the impacts on my mother's side. On my father's side, there were other impacts. So my father's family were landowners in Sylhet, which is why we've got this family name Chaudhry, which means landowner. And the impact that partition had on their lives was that after partition, the power of the landowner dissolved quite quickly in East Pakistan. In West Pakistan, I believe the landlords continued to be politically and feudally quite powerful. But in East Pakistan, like in Punjab, for example, I think landowners and Sindh landowners continued to be powerful for a long time and still are quite powerful. But in East Pakistan, there was a land reform and there was a local government reform. So landowners during the British period in East Bengal had been tax collectors. So people like my grandfather, his father, generations before him were all tax collectors. So they collect tax, own large amounts of land, and they were quite wealthy. However, by about the early 1950s, because of local government reforms, and because of the institution of the Tax Commission of East Pakistan, basically the power of the landlords just diminished because they didn't have a job anymore because tax collection was done by the government. That basically completely destroyed the power of the landowner. Personally, I think that's not a bad thing. I think that's a good thing because landowners, in my opinion, shouldn't be exerting too much power over the peasants because that results in all sorts of exploitation. So personally, I don't think that was a bad thing. However, the impact on my father's family was that the family went from a position of relative sort of wealth and privilege to one of being equal all of a sudden to the villages that they used to sort of rule over. And so they sold up all their lands in the village areas, and they moved into the town into a small house. So that was a massive change in there. And that's partly why my dad immigrated to the UK, because the family was in poverty. I mean, if the land reforms hadn't happened, we would never have thought about going to the UK because they used to live like kings. I've seen what they used to live like. They used to have this huge palatial house in the village where I've seen it, still there. But they had nothing. So I think in different ways, the partition and the decolonization of British India had impacts. You could argue that in some ways, people like my father's family were beneficiaries of colonization, because colonization was what actually afforded them a huge amount of political and civil power in the area, right, which they lost after decolonization. So, yeah, that's, I would say those are just some perspectives.
I'm really conscious of the time. We've got like 10 minutes, and it's probably what, coming up to 11:30 in the evening for you. I want to ask you one quick question, even though we've got lots more from our sheets. But so your father went from nothing to having tea with the Queen. Can you just tell us a little bit about that story, just to end on a lighter note?
Totally. So he was invited to Buckingham Palace twice, I think 1977-ish and about 1981, I think, if I remember correctly. Each time because of services to the community, so garden parties hosted by the Queen, each time because of services that he provided to the community. So some of the stuff that I referred to before, around the work that he was doing in the community. So in addition to, working for Bangladesh Freedom, he also did a lot of work for the immigrant communities in the UK. So for example, if you remember the first Hindi and Urdu language television program that came out in the UK, which was in the late 1960s, there was a program, I think it was called Naya Zindagi, Naya Zivan, which sort of means,
That's
right, new era, new life type of thing, right? So my dad was one of the people that lobbied the BBC to do non-English language program, right? And we used to joke with my dad. We used to say, why did you lobby for a Urdu and Hindi language program when you're a Bengali? And he said, well, that's because I was a Pakistani at the time, and Urdu was our national language, so I just lobbied for it to be in Urdu. He said, I don't really care, I lobbied for it to be in Urdu. So he did stuff like that. So he was very heavily involved in, community types of activities. And, he was a pretty practical sort of guy. He wasn't really looking for the limelight. He was more like wanted to get good stuff done. And luckily enough, he was recognized for that by being invited for going to the palace. And yeah, they were good moments. I remember the day in 81 when my mum and dad went and all dressed up. I still remember I've got a photo, actually. I'll get the photo out for the next time we meet. And they got actually I could probably find it while we're chatting. So it was a great achievement. We were all super amazingly proud of the achievement of getting invited. It meant a whole lot, so it was good, really good. I'm going to see if I can find this photo. I should be able to find this photo. Hopefully I've got it on my I've got all the photos on the drive, right? I think I've shown you this before, my little treasure trove of photographs. So I should have access to this. I can just get there fast enough. I reckon it was about 1981. Oh yeah, there we go. Got it. Yeah, I found it. So right. Okay.
Yeah, I remember that. That's such a beautiful photograph. And your mum's green sari and the smile and the prop in their faces. It just, you can tell that's a very special moment. Very special.
Yeah, the gloves, and if you look at the car, you can see that big white piece of paper that's sellotaped to the window. Yeah. That was the entrance pass to get in to the palace. So if you, I don't know if you can see it now. Hold on. See, it was a big X.
Yeah.
That was basically the ID for driving into the palace grounds. So, Yeah, so that was
I mean,
so.
your insights have been incredibly valuable. And you were talking about what's it called? The program. What's it? Naya
Yeah, it was
Jiva, Naya
Naya,
Jiva.
Naya Zindagi, Naya Zivan.
Yeah. I mean, I was talking about that just yesterday. We were just talking about how important that program was for our parents and grandparents, because it was literally the only Asian language or the Punjabi speaking program, and the only way that our community had any access to hearing their language, because our communities were so small that they didn't have that interaction otherwise, other than in their own home or if they went to a cinema and watched a Bollywood movie. And that interaction was so incredibly important. I remember as a small child being sat, made to be sat in front of the TV watching these old people talking the language that I just about knew, and I was like 4 or 5. And all I remember is the screen, watching these people and you know, all of this music, someone's coming on with a sitar, there's qawwali playing, and just some sort of general information about whatever service is. But I just remember my parents and how very important it was for them. And just because it was important to them, I would make sure that I respected that even as a really young child, because I could really feel how important it was. So your father did such an amazing service that I don't know if you could ever begin to understand how important that was, because that program in itself is something that comes up again and again and again in our interviews to being so important to people. So, you know, thank you on behalf of all of the people that we've interviewed and my own family and my own experience of just that one program. It's invaluable, and you must feel so proud of what your father did. It's I can't begin to express how invaluable that was, but thank you so much. We've got 4 minutes left. Yeah, I mean, you can see where excuse me, where the trajectory of this interview is. It's really important for us to get as many details, as many of these stories that we just don't really realize how important they are until a wider community. A lot of our archives now being used for research about the South Asian community, whether it's the Muslim community or wider. Excuse me, you did the talking, my voice is going. But yeah, the photographs, I know it's such a huge undertaking for you to do this, but if you were able to find some more photographs, especially of those nights out, they're hugely invaluable. We're putting together a heritage walking trail in Oxford, and some of those places that you've mentioned will be on that trail. So to have photographs would be incredibly invaluable. But photographs of you growing up as a child, your family photographs. From them, we get so much information: the clothes you wore, your parents' car, your house. There's so much more detail that researchers and academics can glean from visual references that, you know, that we can't, as well, I can't always appreciate.
Yeah, no, I've got a lot. I'll need to put some of this together. I've got things like newspaper cuttings from the Curry Queen. This
Yeah.
is what year is this? It's probably about the late 1970s. It's probably mid-eight. This is 1985 or so. Yeah, you got stuff like that. I've got loads and loads of things. What I'll need to do, if it's okay with you, is probably spend a bit of time. It'll take me a couple of afternoons. I'll need to sort of go through this myself and see what I've got. It's a pity that I'm not in England, otherwise I'd just, get it, put it all somewhere and come and
Yeah.
meet you. But I've got a lot of stuff. I've got stuff like this, like me, cycling around with
Oh,
myself.
this is perfect. I mean, these were the exact kind of images that we're looking for.
I've got
We've got like 30 seconds left on this meet. So in case we cut off, I'll email you and we'll keep in touch to keep the conversation going because I think there's a lot I can
Let's do
talk
the next
about. And
one in a few weeks, if that's okay, because I'm off to Europe in another 4 days for a week and a bit,
probably
and then
after Ramadan.
after Ramadan. If we do it after Ramadan, it would be better because I'll have enough time to just pull a few things together and enrich the discussion. But I've got a really good idea. I've got a really better idea now also of how you want to weave the stories together. And so I think I'll be able to have enough stuff to keep showing you and et cetera. Yeah, let's just do it that way.
Especially if there's any more details about the lobbying that your father did and the changes that he made, it's really important to get the names of those people who are behind all of that and
Okay, I've got some ideas. I have a WhatsApp group of some contemporaries, and we talk about these things quite a lot. So I'll put the questions in, and I'll try and do some research to pull this together a bit better. I reckon let's just target May, month of May, or so, and not in the next few weeks. Just
No,
give me a bit
that's
of
fine.
time, and let's give this another go, and then hopefully you'll have enough to. Material to sort of edit from.
That'd be amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. I'm going to let you go because
Okay.
otherwise it'll go on
No,
for a very
not at
long
all.
time.
And give my salams to your husband as well. Hope he's well. And
Yeah.
Irfan, right? Irfan?
Yeah, Irfan.
Irfan, yeah. Great. All right. Thanks very much. And see you next time, inshallah.
Hey, good night. Salaam alaikum.
I see you. Alaykum as-salam.